track is Porcelain by Moby. Is there any chance that it makes you think of palm trees, azure blue water lapping at snow white sand? Well, if it does, there's a good reason for that. That song was pretty much the theme for the film The Beach. When it came out at the very beginning of this millennium, it spoke to what can be fantastic about travel to new places, but also about its darker sides. Well, travel as we once knew it no longer exists. Right now, planes are being grounded, borders are closed, and pretty much all over the world, people are being told to stay home. So while travel itself is off the table, it's a good opportunity to say, well, look, why do we do it at all? What do we actually get out of spending days on cramped planes and buses to visit another part of the world? And what have we as individuals and the world as a whole lost thanks to our ability to travel being taken away from us? Well, you've got a group of worldly globetrotter types with us tonight who might have an opinion or two on these very philosophical questions. Now, Emily Thomas is a travel addict and also an associate professor of philosophy at Durham University in the UK. She's also the author of one of the only dedicated books going around on the philosophy of travel. It's called The Meaning of Travel, Philosophers Abroad. Hello, Emily.
Hello there. It's a pleasure to be here.
And thanks so much for being with us. I guess it's a bit of virtual travel for you and I both tonight. We've also got with us Australian travel writer Pamela Watson. Pamela's the author of books, the books Esprit de Batuta, Alone Across Africa on a Bicycle, now in its third edition, and a new book called Gibbous Moon Over Lagos. Pamela has made London her home these days, but she's currently in Perth after her book launch tour was rather rudely interrupted. Hello, Pamela.
Hello, Susan. Nice to be here.
And also in Sydney, we've got author Liam Pieper. His latest novel, Sweetness and Light, has just been released. It's set in Goa, India, and it deals with many of those big philosophy of travel kind of questions. Hi, Liam. Thanks for being here.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, I suppose we should start by establishing your travel cred to be weighing in on this issue. And I want to start by you all sharing your most memorable travel experiences and why they stick in your minds to this day. Emily, let's start with you.
Thank you. For me, without a doubt, my most memorable travel experience was visiting Antarctica. It was like standing on another planet. And I think that is as close as I will ever get.
All right, Pamela, I know you've had amazing adventures. You rode across Africa on a bicycle. You lived and worked in Lagos, the largest city in Nigeria. And that's what you've written about in your books. Hard ask, but can you pick out a moment that's had a lasting impact on you?
A lasting impact? What I remember is that on my bicycle ride deep in the mountains of Cameroon, that I was really struggling. It was muddy, it was wet, and I yet again was welcomed into a small village, and they offered me a bath in a beautiful grotto. I was left by myself to toss water over and wash all that mud off, and I just thought it was magical. And then I came out and I was joined by one of the villagers, and the sun was setting, and it was, but there was clouds, and the sun was over the mountains, layers of mountains into the distance. It was so beautiful. And the villager said to me, I'm so sorry that you had to bathe in that stream. The water's so cold, it brings rheumatism. And then he followed up and he said, oh, this land is so bad. It's so hard to grow things. The hills are so steep. And at that moment, I realised that the way that I was seeing things was romanticising village life, and that it's not romantic at all. So it really, really changed the way in which I interacted with villagers, and so it was a very, very powerful experience.
Oh, that certainly does sound so, Pamela. Liam, what about you? Was there a moment or maybe one that came from researching the book or that really shaped the story that you wanted to tell?
Oh, there are so many. This book is my novel is kind of a thriller set in the seedy underbelly of the backpacker trail. So most of the formative things I can't really remember nor talk about in a public forum. But there was one really pivotal experience, I guess, in writing this book. I was in India, in Bengaluru, right in the middle of it on residency for a few months where I started writing this book. with other writers, most of them from India, in this kind of this austere dance academy right in the middle of the country, which is this this temple for Odissi dancing, where you can go to learn. It's the only place in the world you can still learn this very ancient form of sort of Hindu religious dance. So ambitious teenagers from all over India go there to study. And so it's kind of a cross between this ancient austere temple and the high school from fame. And me and eight other writers were there for 3 months, and we're working on our books. And I got to know a side of the country, this incredibly pluralistic place I really had no idea about before. I got to know some of the people, you know, crime reporters from Mumbai, farmers from Tamil Nadu who, you know, wrote poetry in their spare time. And I realized just how little I knew about this place that I walked into with all sorts of conceptions and preconceptions, and, you know, just how, you know, that's what I wanted to write a book, a love letter to, like this idea that travel is something that never stops humbling you. Yeah.
I might share mine as we're doing this. I think mine would have been when I went to Syria in 2001, straight after September 11, and all the tourists had decided not to go. And I was in Palmyra, which has since been bombed by ISIS. And the man who'd driven the bus to take us to watch the moon rise over a little castle near Palmyra invited my friend and I to dinner. And we went to his house and we sat on the floor with him and his wife. And they were so generous to us. They had spent what must have been an incredible amount of money on this dinner, and they just insisted that we eat and eat and eat, and they wouldn't let us stop. And they were just so kind. And they said, look, we don't like it that you're staying at a hotel. You know, that's taking up all your money. They said, look, come sleep in our house. We'll all just go sleep in the kitchen, which was the only other room, and you guys can stay in the living room. And, you know, we didn't. But that was one of those moments that struck me, is the incredible generosity of people who were being maligned to the world over, but who really was so friendly and just wanted to be understood and to reach out and talk to people from other countries. So look, that's mine that I'm putting in there. Emily, why do we travel? You're the philosopher on this. What is it that's going on when we decide to hit the road?
So leisure travel in the West starts in the 17th century with the Grand Tour. And people back then really had two motivations. The first official motivation was education. People saw it as a way of finishing off their young noblemen, that they could learn languages, become cultured, see the arts and great sights of Europe. The dark underbelly of that Grand Tour was debauchery. Everybody wanted to drink, visit prostitutes, even play tennis, things that they just couldn't do at home. And these two motivations, I think, have lasted for a long time.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like the backpacker trial, except for the tennis.
People have termed the psychological turn, where suddenly travel is all about a spiritual journey. You're traveling to change yourself, to learn about the world. And I think that is the thing that is still largely with us today. If you look at tourist motivations, the World Tourism Organization has collected some of the top motivations together, and they're still along those lines. Things like travel to change, travel to show, and the Instagram generation. So I think people's motivations are varied, but a lot of them are rooted in this idea of spiritual growth.
All right, but you did say there's travel to show, which you pointed to the Instagram generation. That's not about spiritual growth, is it?
Yeah, I'm so sorry. You're cutting out a tiny bit. If you could repeat the question.
Oh, Emily, I was just saying, you mentioned the Instagram generation who are traveling to show. That doesn't sound like it has a lot in common with spiritual growth.
I think that might be true, except I think one of the things they want to show is their growth. They want to show that they're learning about different cultures, you know, different foods, different kinds of things in the world. So I think they are linked.
Emily, what about the way that travel puts us in touch with the unfamiliar, the things that are difficult to do in your regular life? Obviously, the debauchery is sometimes a part of that, but it challenges us in other ways, doesn't it?
I'm so sorry. You're cutting out a bit. So perhaps I should try and change the setup with your producers.
All right, Emily, that's a good idea. Why don't I have a chat with Liam and Pamela, and then we'll see what we can do so that we can make sure that you can hear me, because that's a bit of a problem. All right, Pamela, what is it for you that makes you want to travel? What drives you?
I like to think of it as two things. One is adventure, that and for me, adventure is just not knowing how the day will end, and I get an adrenaline rush out of the unexpected. And I got that both on my bike ride, because I'm moving on and I didn't know how the day will end. And I got that living in Lagos for 10 years, where any day can end up completely different from what you originally planned. And I find that exciting. And then secondly, what I'm looking for is to explore. And for me, and perhaps it's because I've spent many years traveling and I've been to over 80 countries. I'm not so interested in ticking off the sites, but I like to explore how people see things and challenge my own assumptions and to really get inside the minds of others. And in fact, my first book, Esprit de Batuta, was named after Ibn Battuta, who was a 14th century Moroccan who travelled three times as far as Marco Polo, so before Emily's romantic era of travel. But people asked me if I was travelling the same route as someone like Livingstone, you know, and so it was to be a journey replicating somebody else's exploration. And my shorthand was to say that I was travelling like Ibn Battuta with curiosity, because I really was curious about the cultures that I was travelling through. For me, that's the second leg. And I think increasingly there's become a third leg, which is about giving back, because to have received the generosity of so many people, both in villages and in the city, whether it's hospitality like you got in Syria or mentorship when I'm out of my depth and trying to run a social enterprise in a completely different culture. Those things make you want to give back. It's not just about me taking things away, but also being able to give back.
Liam Pieper, what would you say is that drives you to travel?
Oh, boy. I think that's changed over the years. You know, the motivation's different every time one gets on a plane. If I can gently push back at the much maligned Instagram generation, I think there is a school of philosophy amongst young people today that if one does the perfect yoga pose and does not record it for Instagram, can it be said to have really happened? It's, a deep philosophical argument. That's definitely been a motivation for my own travel. When I was a little younger, I guess travel was a way. I think adventure was the most important thing. You know, it's a way of testing your boundaries and your limits and finding out who you are. You know, perhaps travel is a way of confirming a hypothesis you have about the world or maybe about yourself. Yeah, I was thinking, just now, as Emily mentioned, the Grand Tour and that, the noblemen who would be finished off, a wonderful turn of phrase, when they travelled around the world. A million years ago, I wrote my academic thesis on Flaubert, and he was a great traveller, Gustave Flaubert, who wrote Madame Bovary. He was very much an advocate of the Grand Tour and travel as sort of a philosophical tool. I think his big quote was, travel makes one modest because you see what a tiny place you occupy in the world. I think that's very true. It does make you modest, but it also can make you a bit of a braggart, as Flaubert would have been. Hence maybe the Instagram bench that young people are on these days.
We've got Emily back. Emily Thomas is the Associate Professor of Philosophy at Durham University in the UK. Emily, I've got my fingers and toes crossed that you can hear me clearly. Emily, we just talked to Liam and Pamela about what motivates them. I mean, you told us about what some of the philosophical ideas are. What about what actually motivates you to travel?
For me, I think it's also been adventure. I wanted to see what's out there in the world. And I find it really reassuring to appreciate how much there is I just don't know. I feel like in everyday life, things are very familiar. Familiar people around you, familiar places, clothes, foods. It's so wonderful to go out into the world and realize that you know almost nothing. I really enjoy that experience.
Now, Emily, what about the different kinds of travel? There's a regular and kind of tired argument around the difference between travelers and tourists. Are the two experiences as different as some like to make out?
I personally don't think that they are at all. So this tired argument dates to a book called Abroad by Paul Fussell. He published it 20 odd years ago now. And Fussell argues that for the traveller, it's all about exploration and adventure. And in contrast, for the tourist, it's all about retreading tired old paths. And he talks about Mediterranean pop villages in a scathing way. So clearly for Fussell, proper travel is going off and trekking through Africa like Pamela did. And you're not really a traveller if you're just visiting regular tourist sites. I just think Fussell is wrong. It seems to me that we are all tourists when we travel. What I do think might be at the root of what he's getting at is the fact that some trips can involve more unfamiliarity than others. So that when you trek across a continent, you're going to encounter many more things that are alien to you. And that, I think, is what people talk about when they say things like, I'm a traveller, not a tourist.
Liam, you put some of those traveller archetypes in Sweetness and Light. You've got the very seedy expat and the tourist looking for enlightenment at the yoga retreat. How closely do those characters match with people you've met travelling?
Quite closely. I mean, archetypes are there for a reason. You do tend to encounter familiar people as you travel and as you see more of the world. I must agree that there is much difference between a traveller and a tourist, really. It's a bit of a false binary, I think. A more interesting division of people, I think, is the idea of the expat versus an immigrant. That's something I was very interested in this book. You know, what makes the difference between someone who moves to a new country to start a new life and takes on the label of expat, you know. I thought about it a lot while I was writing, and I guess the answer is just privilege, cultural or financial privilege. And, you know, that's something that I found very interesting. I found traveling all around the world, you'll find communities of people who move, who adopt a new country and they're, and a new culture, but manage to hang on to many of their old prejudices from their old lives and their old culture and their old milieu. That's something that's very interesting, and that's something that I found common to travel all across the world. That's an interesting way to look at it.
Liam, by and large, I would think those people who live those very expat lives come with the privilege when they go live in those other countries, and sometimes you can afford the maid and you can afford all those things, which mean that you're living a life of luxury compared to many of the people that you're living in the same place with.
Yes, which becomes particularly interesting when you adopt some of the cultural practices, I guess. I got to know a lot of yogis when I was, you know, both in through growing up in Melbourne and, you know, traveling throughout India a few times later on in life. And, you know, watching the way that culture, for example, has been absorbed and mutated in various ways. You know, there's the old yogis, which are hundreds of years old, and then there's, Bikram Vinyasa Yoga, and then there's Cardio Yoga Attack, which comes free with my gym membership. They're all elements of a culture. They've just been subsumed by this, all-encompassing expatriate hunger for new experience. That's something that I was very interested in interrogating in my writing. That probably wasn't too relevant to your question. I apologize.
It's quite all right. That's the idea of travel, can take us into unexpected places. You're on Nightlife with Suzanne Hill on this Saturday night. I'm here filling in for Indira and I Do. Look, we're talking about why we travel, what we get out of it, what we give back from it. I wonder if you've got any thoughts on this that you'd like to share. What really motivates you? I guess Emily Thomas, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Durham University in the UK and the author of The Meaning of Travel, Philosophers Abroad. Liam Pieper's on the phone with us. His novel Sweetness and Light follows an Australian expat and an American tourist in Goa, India. And Pamela Watson is a travel writer and author of the books Esprit de Batuta, Alone Across Africa on a Bicycle, and The New Gibbous Moon Over Lagos. Now, Pamela, Liam mentioned the difference between expats and immigrants. Now, you lived that life because you lived in Lagos, Nigeria, as you told us, for 10 years. Do you have reflections on whether there's a difference between an immigrant and an expat and how people get really absorbed in their communities?
I think, you know, when you go to live long-term in a different culture, the mindset of a traveller being open to that culture, sometimes you can feel like you've learned a lot and then things happen and you realise that you haven't. So my journey into Lagos, as I stayed there, was really a journey of two halves, where in the first half I probably fitted the expatriate model because I was benefiting from a large company, Compound, which was my partner, had an international employer. And I was able to work for a consulting practice and then set up my own businesses and social enterprise under that umbrella. But after he was transferred away, that's when I became not an immigrant, but my experience was entirely different because I was living a life that was much more exposed to the everyday culture of doing business in Nigeria and just how difficult it is. And, you know, in those first 5 years, I thought I knew how to work. I thought I was an old hand, that I was experienced. And then you find that you're not. And then you're really reliant on other people to help be your guides. So I think the really important thing is that you've just got to keep on pinching yourself to open up your mind and to realise that you need help and that, you know, to navigate these different cultures.
Did you find yourself reverting to sort of, you know, anger or old prejudices in that second half of it when you found yourself up against a system that was actually difficult for you to navigate? Did you sit there thinking, why can't it be more like it is in Australia?
I was there because I was really addicted to the roller coaster. Mm. And it is an emotional roller coaster living in a place like Lagos, that you can have the highs of your life when you're working together and things go well and you feel like you're contributing and changing things, and there's so much to be done, and so it really, really is quite invigorating. And then you're plunged into the lows, which can be because the system is something that you encounter, and, you know, you're blocked from winning a contract, you're not getting paid, you don't understand why are things going wrong. But it can also just be that you wake up in the morning and there's no water, and yet you've got an important meeting. So how do you, you know, have a shower? Oh, my goodness, you know, the generator's not working. Oh, the traffic's bad. You're caught in a, you know, three-hour ghost light. So basically you're constantly living on your wits as to how you are navigating this. And I think life, when it becomes, you know, in Australia, is much less extreme. And so for me, one of the real stimulants that kept me there was not that I wanted Lagos to be more like Australia. It was that I was addicted to these highs and lows.
Now, we're going to ask Emily, who's got a philosophical answer for us in a moment, about the idea that we change when we travel. But Pamela, has travel changed you? I mean, you needed a certain personality in the first place to want to put yourself onto that roller coaster and ride its highs and lows. But did you come away fundamentally changed after you'd lived there for 10 years?
Yes, and it's been a constant shaping process. You know, when I first finished my bicycle ride, 18 months cycling, you know, through 17 countries, I got back to London and my friend said, "Have you changed?" And, you know, I looked and I thought, well, no, you know, I'm the same person. I couldn't see any changes. But within very short order, I started making different choices about the friends that I had and how I spent my time. And indeed, my decision to go back to Africa and try and carve out a longer term life in Africa stemmed from that. And so, you know, that they're the changes. I think my values as well became a lot more conscious of my values. Perhaps they'd already been there, but in a place like Africa, and when you're doing business, you're constantly confronted with ethical choices, because if you follow what your ethics, and you're wanting to do business the right way, there are going to be consequences, negative consequences for you. So, you know, daily you're challenged, but that makes your values really real. So I'm not sure that they've changed, but I'm very conscious about ethics now.
Emily Thomas, the Associate Professor of Philosophy at Durham University. Emily, how much truth is there in the idea that we change when we travel? What does the science suggest?
I think there's a lot of truth in the idea that we change when we travel. And there's been an awful lot of scientific research looking into the way travel can make you more creative. It can make you more open-minded. Like, this stuff has been fairly well explored. Like, what's been a bit less well explored is exactly why that is.
Oh, do you want to tell us why, Emily? We still got you there?
Absolutely. So, you might simply think we change when we travel because we are having new experiences, building new memories. I have a slightly left-wheel theory, and the theory goes like this. There's a theory in the philosophy of mind called the extended mind thesis. And on this view, your mind is not just your brain. It's your mind. Your mind is your brain, and there's other stuff in your cognitive environment. So if you think about two people wandering around an art gallery, one of them is very forgetful, so he takes lots of notes in his notebook, whereas the other one just remembers everything. At the end of the gallery, they're having a conversation with friends, and with the aid of the notebook, the forgetful person is able to explain just as much about the paintings that he's seen as the non-forgetful person. And this leads people to think that your mind can extend beyond your skull into the environment around you. And I think that's one reason why we change through travel, that it's possible to leave our cognitive environments behind. So when you go abroad, you can leave your notebook, your mobile phone, your laptop, even your clothes, your books. You can leave all of those things behind and enter an entirely new cognitive environment. And I think this explains why some people change so much when they travel.
Has it changed you, Emily, over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, the reason I like this theory is because it fits my experience of how it felt to be abroad without any of those familiar things. It certainly made me more open-minded and I think more humble, actually, because you are constantly reminded of how little you know.
I have to say, something I always enjoy about it is feeling like I'm free of all the titles that I have when I'm at home. When I'm at home, I'm about my job, I'm about being a parent, I'm about, you know, being a wife. But when I go overseas, I feel like I'm just me if I go overseas on my own.
That's true. Absolutely, yeah. All your regular social relations are stripped away as well. It can be very freeing.
Now, Ross in Perth has given us a call. Ross, hello. I'm just like, yeah, yes, I can work the phones. Good. Hello, Ross.
Hi. Lovely to hear your voice. Look, my wife, my late wife and I went on a special trip some years ago, a trip of a lifetime, and we went to China, we went to Mongolia, we went to Siberia, Russia, etc. Now, you people have conceptions about China and Russia and all this. I have to tell you, my favourite city in the world that I've ever been to was Moscow. And we went to Beijing, we went to Tiananmen Square, we did all this stuff. And I never saw a gun anywhere. And people were lovely. And we went up through into Mongolia. We went up into the mountains and we spent some time with the people there, riding the ponies and firing the bows. It's just to get a different perspective of the different people is unbelievable. But I have to say, my experience of Russia was just fantastic. Are you there?
Yes.
It was just, Moscow was unbelievable. I went down to Red Square at 11:30 at night while my wife was asleep and took photos. And I never felt unsafe at any time. And Moscow is just such a cosmopolitan city, and people have a really wrong opinion about it. This is what's good about travel. You go and experience it for yourself. We went to Helsinki and then down to Paris and Rome and down to Turkey and all that. But to go through Moscow, to travel on the Trans-Siberian train, was one of the most fantastic experiences of our lives. And these people are no different to us. They're wonderful people.
So Ross, is it for you about getting rid of some of those preconceptions about places when you go to somewhere?
And, yeah. Absolutely. Yes. You have to stop thinking about these people as ogres and all this stuff. And they're lovely people, you know. Yeah, exactly.
All right, Ross, thank you. We've got a lot to talk about still with our three guests, but thank you so much. I mean, I think that is one of the fundamental points. Emily, you'd know, who was it who said something like travel is fatal to prejudice? Do you know the quote?
French philosopher René Descartes. He thought that was one of the great benefits of travel, that it could shake assumptions that are so deeply held you don't even realise they're assumptions.
Emily Thomas is the Associate Professor of Philosophy at Durham University. We've got Liam Pieper with us, the author of Sweetness and Light. Pamela Watson, a travel writer and author of the books Esprit de Batuta and Gibbous Moon over Lagos. Emily, what about what travel brings to the world? There are lots of things that individual travellers get out of the experience. Does it go both ways? Beyond the economic, do some of those benefits actually flow back to the places that travellers go to?
Yes, I certainly hope so. I think cultural exchange is always a good thing. Human beings are always looking at the world from their own singular perspective. And I think that exchanging perspectives is always really valuable, always.
Now, Pamela, you were talking about, obviously, an essential part of your philosophy now is that you want to put back. In what ways do you think it's important to put back?
I maintain a continuing relationship with friends, with former employees, with people who I've encountered in different ways in Lagos and in other countries of Africa. I know that I contributed a lot through my businesses that to this day, whether it's through LinkedIn or being found on Facebook or being on a plane to Lagos and somebody coming up to me and saying, "Oh, you Pamela, do you remember? I did one of your training programs." People tell me about how my work actually affected them. That's one way. But I think that exchange, I was the honorary consul for Australia in Lagos during my time there, and I was very conscious of trying to promote not just the Australian community coming together, but the Australian community more integrated with Nigerians in their midst, because for many Australians who were there, they were expatriates living in these compounds, and their interaction was limited to their house staff or to their work colleagues. And by creating events where people could talk about Anzac Day, Australia Day, Nigeria's independence, it really opened up people's eyes and just formed friendships. So I felt that was an important contribution. And then, it leads to trade. It leads to people coming and being students, Nigerians coming to Australia and being students and then, taking back our values to contribute to their own society. So there's many direct and indirect ways. Right now with coronavirus, it's more about directly helping through remittances to people because, in these societies, there's not a social safety net. And so, it's really important just to be able to help them quite directly with finance.
And is that what you're doing?
Yes. Yes. And that's what I've been reaching out to. I know many Nigerians in the diaspora. And, you know, I've been inquiring about, you know, what are the initiatives that are there to be able to support, you know, particularly in Lagos, because that's the area that I know people. And for so many, people have family networks, they have work networks, they have you know, clubs, they people belong to many different networks, and remittances are a very direct way in which the diaspora help people in those networks. So I'm not unusual in that. You know, and it's a function that the society doesn't have the same level of you know, NGOs in place that one knows what they're doing and how the help is being directed, I think. So, you know, there are some very good initiatives that are happening, but you know, you at the end of the day, you want to help people that you know.
Mm. Emily, as Pamela's alluded to, of course, the last couple of weeks has seen this global retreat inwards, travellers and expats alike leaving places they've been living maybe for years, and often they've been leaving countries that won't be able to deal with this pandemic as well as somewhere like Australia, or in your case, the UK, although, of course, the UK is copping it pretty hard. What do you think this says about the nature of the relationship that we have with the places that we like to travel?
That's a good question. I mean, people like to travel all over the world, you know, to Europe and Australia, as well as to lesser developed countries. My sense is certainly in Europe, that countries are looking to help themselves first and then looking to help other nations around them. I know that European nations are funneling money into other parts of the world, but there's certainly a sense of we need to get ourselves locked down first and then look to everywhere else. That's my impression from reading the news.
I must say, I mean, I was actually in the Philippines probably a month ago now and got told, look, the tour's ending, you've got to go home. It was a real rush to get a flight, get out, get down before they close the country. But just the knowledge that the tour guide that I'd been with was now going to be out of work for as long as this went on, that he had no social security, no other income, and was basically staring down the barrel of poverty coming for the next 6 months, while all those people who'd been on the tour with him, you know, gave him a nice tip and rushed back to their own countries. There was this real sense of, you know, even though you didn't want to be feeling like it, but it felt like, oh, it's every man for himself, isn't it? Liam, I know you've seen this go both ways. Tell us what you've observed in the last few weeks.
Well, it's been sobering and quite frightening to realise just how arbitrary lines on the map are when they come to something like this. Watching, you know, every nation on earth is being stress tested in a way they haven't been for a long time, in some cases never. And, you know, social equities, which have, you know, have lain unexamined for a long time, are coming to the surface in quite horrifying ways. But to take it back, you know, that ties into what you were just, what we're just talking about with the expats. I was talking to my friend in Hong Kong, and a lot of, you know, a lot of people that she's friends with and who work with their European expats who lived in Hong Kong for professional reasons fled when the virus was predominantly in China and went back to their European families and homes, and have since fled back to Hong Kong because that's the perceived safe haven. And, of course, they're bringing the virus with them. And a lot of Hong Kong's new cases are with that. So it's an astonishing time when, you know, old social, I guess, sort of social safety nets and the lines between who is privileged and who is not, they're really being tested. Mm. I've seen a lot of that going on around the world right now. In terms of people without that, I guess, that cushion, that room to move around with latitude, it's rough, you know. I've got friends all over the world who, you know, many of them with young families in cities where the future is incredibly uncertain. You know, I live in Sydney. You know, it's not ideal here, but we've been pretty lucky. But in places like Mumbai, London, you know, northern Italy, where I have family, it's, you know, it's a terrifying time. And, you know, I never thought that the, you know, in the naivety of my own life, I never thought there would be a time when waters would no longer be permeable, you know, when there would be no more planes in the sky over Sydney, you know, over London. It's, you know, an astonishing and unprecedented time to be alive.
Emily, one day this pandemic will end, travel will open up again. Will it be the same?
I don't think it will be the same, actually, no. I certainly think travel will recover. We've been travelling for thousands and thousands of years. I don't think that's going to go away. But I imagine that this unprecedented lockdown will have an impact, and perhaps in positive ways. So we've known for a long time that things like air travel and lots of it is not good for the environment. And I imagine many people have thought it's simply impossible for that to stop, but it has stopped. And I hope that will lead to positive changes in the way we travel. If all of us are conducting business now via Skype and Zoom, then I hope that lasts, frankly, and that perhaps we focus on travel as a leisure activity and slower travel, where we're flying a lot less and we're spending longer in the places that we're going through. Slow travel, traveling more mindfully. I think that would be a wonderful outcome.
Pamela, what are your thoughts on what travel will be like when the borders are open and the planes start flying again?
I think it's very it is going to be different, and it's hard to know. I mean, with low oil prices, with airlines bailed out but in debt, they're going to need traffic volume. So, you know, you might see prices fall. Cruise ships might, you know, they've still got those ships. So they might have to really drop the prices. So in some ways, it might kick up. My greater fear is that actually it's what Emily's talking about, that people will start to lock in and only do local travel, because this is going to be with us for a long time before our own borders open up, but also before we actually trust going to the inside the borders of other countries, you know, particularly those whose health systems aren't very strong or haven't yet got control of the virus. And I think that's a pity, because, you know, we do travel to expand our minds and you know, to respect other cultures. And if we lock ourselves away, then, you know, how do we do that? And then secondly, you know, this is a huge industry. It has grown over the last 60 years, this mass travel. You know, so I think it's about 9 or 10% of employment in the planet is associated with the travel industry. So, you know, think of all those poor countries. If everybody just decides to stay home, you know, those people that you met in the Philippines, who, you know, they won't just suffer for this period. They'll be really unemployed. So I'm hoping that the scenario is more robust, that you know, it will take time. You know, and I'm thinking 2 to 5 years before it starts to recover, and undoubtedly it will be different. But, you know, I do hope that we remain open to others. And on that, I think one of my greatest disappointments at the moment is in, you know, we are in a privileged place here in Australia, and we have responded in very many positive ways to support our neighbours, our communities, you know, people less fortunate. But I don't think we've done that terrific a job of really opening our arms to people who don't have an Australian passport, to the backpackers, even to the grey nomads, you know, who are travelling through, as I was at the time of the unfolding crisis. You could really feel that you were being treated as a bit of a typhoid Mary come to town. And then, you know, the poor cruise ship passengers who have been left to languish. So, you know, I think we need to consider that if we push people away now, are they going to welcome us back? And are they going to come back? So, you know, there's some of the things I've been reflecting on.
Liam, how do you see travel changing after the borders open again?
Well, to echo that thought, I do hope that we don't push people away as a country. You know, in addition to travellers, great nomads, students, you know, the higher education system in this country is desperately reliant on international students, and to push them away will be disastrous for our research and academic cultures. Where do I see travel going? I hope that when borders finally open, that we are not further away as countries. I hope that nationalism doesn't come between people of different nations. You know, I think we've got a chance here to, you know, come together as a species, you know, as a planet, to try and fight this thing and realize that we're all in it together. And hopefully we won't, you know, allow xenophobia to become part of the response to it. If the first thing does happen, if we can get closer, I would like to see, I will miss being able to jump on a plane and, you know, zip across the world. But I would like to see a return to that, even if, you know, it is a little slower. If, you know, we take the time. I wish I'd taken time on various trips I've taken now to appreciate it more, to know that that is finite, you know. With nothing but time on my hand now, I can look back on the sheer amount of carbon miles I've racked up in search of adventure or for work or to research a novel. And while I don't regret any of that experience, I do regret, you know, not taking a bit of a Proustian approach to the whole thing and just realizing how lucky and how precious it was. So I'd like to see a bit of that in travel going forward, if there's ever an option again, you know, to slow down and, you know, smell the roses. So to speak, you know.
Yeah, Liam, you wrote a piece in The Guardian last month, you know, sort of related to your novel, but you said, you know, you hope that the book would make people rethink some of their travel habits. How so?
I guess chiefly travel as a list-checking exercise, you know. The idea of, a lot of people's first travel experience is, say, a bus tour of Europe, you know, which is fine. You know, it's a great adventure. But you turn up at a place and you're there for, you know, a few hours, you get a photo and a sandwich, and then you move on. And what do you really gain from that? Apart from, you know, good company. It's about the people you meet along the way, but it's not really about the place, maybe. So I guess what I wanted people to think about was that when they travel, they are, you know, they're in somebody's home. It's somebody's, you're traveling through someone's backyard, and things aren't necessarily going to be done the way that you're used to. And one should be very mindful of one's manners, you know, to parrot my grandmother, forgive me. And particularly when socioeconomics come into play, you know, if you are from a more socially fortunate country, I mean socioeconomically fortunate country, and you find yourself in a comparative economy where the exchange rate lets you live with all the consequence of a monopoly game, there's a certain responsibility to be respectful and pay attention to where you're at. Mm. And, you know, when travel can resume, hopefully, one day, that's something to think about too, you know. A tourist can be an annoying thing. You know, I lived in Prague for a while, and I'll be happy if I never see another Bucks party in my life. But, you know, as tourists, as travellers, whatever the adjective you want to attach to that, you do have a chance to invest in communities and in people and to experience something real. It just might take a little effort on your behalf to get through to that. Mm.
Emily, I know that's one of the things that you think would be wonderful if people did more of, and that's really thinking about the places that they're going before they travel and really trying to understand them a bit more.
Yeah, it is. There's this theory in philosophy of art that the best way to understand an artwork is to know a lot about it, to understand the painter, the context, the technique, And I think that exactly the same thing goes for places in the world. I think that the more we understand them, the more we enjoy them, the more we're going to get out of being there. So if there are places that you're planning to visit after the lockdown's end, I think research them now, learn about them. I think that will enhance your enjoyment of the visit later.
Well, I'm afraid we are almost out of time. It's been so wonderful talking to the three of you. Thank you so much for being part of the program. Emily Thomas, the Associate Professor of Philosophy at Durham University in the UK and author of The Meaning of Travel, Philosophers Abroad. Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
Pamela Watson, travel writer and author of the books Esprit de Batuta, Alone Across Africa on a Bicycle, and The New Gibbous Moon Over Lagos. Pamela, lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Susan. It was great.
And Liam Piper, who has been joining us from Sydney, author and journalist. His latest novel, Sweetness and Light, follows an Australian expat and an American tourist in Goa. Liam, thanks so much for being part of our discussion.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there you go. The philosophy of travel for you in a nutshell on Nightlife.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.